Court is back in session.
Please be seated. We have the consolidated cases of Villegas versus a Judicial District Court. If counsel are ready to proceed, please do so.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Andre Mura, and along with Peter Weatherall, my co-counsel, I represent the petitioners, the Villegas family. Your Honor, may I please reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you. This case concerns the Keep Our Doctors in Nevada initiative, which the voters enacted in 2004. Prior to the initiative's enactment, the Nevada law provided that in an action for damages for medical malpractice, the non-economic damages awarded to each plaintiff from each defendant must not exceed $350,000, except upon a showing by clear and convincing evidence of gross negligence or exceptional circumstances. This court in Jones versus Heller described what changes the initiative would make to that existing law. It said, quote, if passed, the initiative would simply remove the two statutory exceptions to the existing $350,000 cap. That is the only change that this court in Jones versus Heller identified that the initiative would make to the existing law. 6 years later, the district court in this case concluded that the initiative had made a third and radical change to the prior cap, a change that this court never identified, that the Secretary of State never described in the ballot materials, and a change that the arguments supporting the initiative's passage did not describe. According to the district court, in enacting CODIN, the voters intended to establish a cap that applies for all plaintiffs and all defendants. That is contrary to the text of the cap statute, NRS 41A.035, the ballot materials submitted to the voters, this court's precedents construing a materially identically worded statutory limitation on damages, and wrongful death law generally. I'd like to first turn to the text of the statute. And the parties agree that one of the central questions is the meaning of in an action. And that is a term of art that this court has interpreted to mean cause of action. It did so in County of Clark versus Upchurch, a case which concerned another statutory limitation on damages that was contained basically the same material words, and in Parker versus Chrysler Motors, which concerned the wrongful death statute. And in that case, the statute which provided that an action may be maintained by the heirs, this court concluded that an action means cause of action. So in both those contexts, an action was defined by this court as a cause of action. And that is the meaning of the term in the cap statute at issue today. In Upchurch, the court concluded that the cap was further limited to the aggregate number of defendants. And although it concluded that the language of the statutory scheme at issue there didn't make clear whether it was so further limited, it concluded that based on prior precedent, in other cases it had limited the award to the aggregate defendants, that it would follow that precedent and that any further extension of the sovereign immunity in that case would have to come from the legislature. But in this case, if you look at the statutory scheme, and that's both the cap statute and NRS 41.085, which is the statute establishing the wrongful death cause of action, it is evident that this cap is not further limited to the aggregate number of defendants. And that is clear first because the statute establishing the wrongful death cause of action permits each heir to maintain a cause of action against the wrongdoer and any other individual who committed the wrong.
Well, isn't that what the previous statute did, 41A031?
Yes, Your Honor. That is what the previous statute did. And the language of the statute, inaction, is the same in both cases. And the only change that this court identified in Jones versus Heller between the prior cap statute and the statute that would be enacted by the initiative was the removal of the two statutory exceptions. And that is the only change that the Coden initiative makes to Nevada law. So also, the cap statute provides, it defines a provider, the defendant, a provider of healthcare services in the singular. So again, that is another indication that for each cause of action against a provider singular, that there is a separate limitation there for each. The court in County of Clark versus Upchurch focused on the fact that inaction was singular and arising out of an act or occurrence, which was referring to the tort at issue there, was also singular. And here, in the statute at issue here, both are also singular. And that, again, informs whether this cap applies per plaintiff, per claim, as we contend that it does. Now, I'd like to point the court to a concession made in the Valley Health brief, and that is, in its discussion of what the voters were told, Valley Health and Dr. Sheik admit that the voters were never told about the statute's applicability. What they say is that the ballot initiative was silent as to these matters. Now, we disagree that the ballot initiative was silent. If you look at the ballot initiative, and it's in the appendix, it says repeatedly that the law, if passed, would limit the non-economic damages that a plaintiff singular could recover from a provider of healthcare. And not once does the ballot initiative ever indicate that the statute would be applied so that in a case with multiple plaintiffs, that award would be split among the plaintiffs. Nor does it indicate that it could be the case that if in a personal injury action, a plaintiff files suit first, and then because there is no compulsory joinder as there is in the wrongful death cause of action, you could have a subsequent action in which a plaintiff files suit. And so in the first case, you could have the $350,000 cap exhausted, and there would be no non-economic damages available to the subsequent plaintiff. It doesn't mention any of these possibilities. All it indicates is that a plaintiff could recover up to $350,000 from a defendant practitioner of healthcare. But their concession is nonetheless an important one because they are conceding that it doesn't, and we agree, doesn't tell the voters that the Coden initiative, and if enacted, would apply per incident. And yet they conclude that even though we know that the ballot initiative never told the voters that it would apply per incident, they urge the court to look at statements of lobbyists that were made almost 2 years before the vote on the initiative. And they asked the court to presume that the voters did know, even though at the same time they admit that the voters were never told that the law would apply per incident. And that's simply a legal fiction that the court should not entertain, because the ballot initiative materials, the Secretary of State is charged with providing the voters with a fair and impartial explanation of what the law would provide. And what the voters go to the ballot box, that those are the materials presented to them. And they make a decision based on those materials. And those materials never inform the voters that the statute would apply per incident. We have an amicus brief from the Coden group itself, which tells a very different story. They say that the purpose of this initiative was always to establish a per incident cap. But that's simply not credible, because if you look at the arguments supporting the initiative's passage, which were written by the Coden group, you will not see a single statement from them urging the voters to vote for this initiative because it would make that change. So while here they're saying that change is instrumental, it's important to keep doctors in Nevada, that's not something they ever told the voters. That's not one of the bases for which they said that the cap should be enacted. Instead, what they said was, this law would establish a $350,000 limit that a plaintiff singular would be able to be awarded. But again, there's no indication from them, although now they are saying that a per incident cap is what the state needs. That's not what they told the voters, and that's not what was before the voters. Also, the Secretary of State's condensation and explanation is based on the petition provided to it from the group that sponsors the initiative. So it is a summary based on the materials given, in this case, by the Coden group. And yet clearly the Secretary of State, just as this court did in Jones versus Heller, did not see any basis in the new Coden initiative and the language it proposed to suggest that this law, if enacted, would establish a per incident cap. And that is a material change from what the existing law was.
Counsel, is there anything we should take from either the South Dakota law application or the California application of their similar statute?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the South Dakota, if you look at that statute is similar in language. It says in any action. And again, the court there had the interpretive problem of whether action refers to cause of action. And it concluded that it did. And it concluded just based on wrongful death law, which is similar to this case, where each heir has a cause of action, damages are awarded in view of each heir's separate relational interest to the defendants. So that decision and that statutory framework is very similar to the statutory framework at issue here. The California statute is not similar in language to this statute at issue here. They have urged the court to presume that this statute was based on California law. But when the court applies that presumption, it does so when the language, and we've cited several cases in our brief, it does so when the language is identical or nearly identical. That's how a legislative body tells the court, we want the exact same interpretation. They copy the language. Here the language wasn't copied. There are material differences between the California cap, including the numerical amount at which it sets, $250,000. And also, this court looks to another jurisdiction when there has been a decision of that highest court interpreting the law. And there is no California Supreme Court decision interpreting their cap. All that there is a Court of Appeals decision. So the presumption does not apply in that case. The presumption that we presume that this law was based on California law does not apply here. But the South Dakota law is, we offer it because it's an example of a statute that is similarly worded where the wrongful death law is very similar and it's persuasive in our view.
Counsel, what specifically do you consider to be material differences between California Civil Code Section 33332 and NRS 41A035? That would cause this court to disregard the California statute and the appellate court's interpretation of it?
Well, again, this court's presumption that a statute interpreted by the highest court of another state will guide this court in its interpretation when the language is identical. And here the language is not identical. If they had wanted the identical language, they could have proposed that identical language. But that is not what they proposed.
Well, what's the material difference between the two, in your view?
If I could have a moment to turn to that language, Your Honor. Well, first that says, in no action shall the amount of damages for non-economic losses exceed $250,000. And there is no reference to the plaintiff there. Here the injured plaintiff is in the singular. So that informs the fact that in a cause of action, which is what in an action means, this court has routinely defined that to mean cause of action, the injured plaintiff, singular, may be awarded non-economic damages up to $350,000 in such an action. So that language is different, and that's a material change. Because if you focus on the injured plaintiff in the wrongful death context, each injured plaintiff, by statute, under NRS 41.0854, is permitted to receive non-economic damages for their losses based on the separate relational interests between them and the decedent.
But in subparagraph A of the California Civil Code, it says the injured plaintiff, using plaintiff singularly as well.
Well, it is a differently worded statute. It's a statutory scheme that's different. So, but we otherwise disagree, and we've said this in our brief, that they are ignoring, California decision is ignoring the fact that the injured plaintiff is singular. They give no credence to that. And this court instead does not interpret the singular to include the plural where the context does not require it or where a particular statute does not permit it. And here the context of wrongful death law is very clear since Parker versus Chrysler Motors, which is that each individual plaintiff has a cause of action and that each individual plaintiff may be awarded damages in view of their losses. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Dennis Kennedy for Respondent Valley Health Systems. Let's go to the two statutes. The last question that the court asked counsel. They are not identical, but they are really close. The California statute says in an action, the California statute says in any action. The Nevada statute says in an action. The term in the California statute is the injured plaintiff, precisely the same term as in the Nevada statute. Nevada statute in such an action, and the California statute in no action. If you read those two statutes, they are saying essentially the same thing. The words are not identical, but if you look at the California Court of Appeals decision in Yates, which we would suggest is the proper analytical framework for this court to apply, California Court of Appeals simply says, look, this statute is unambiguous on its face. It means that there is a $250,000 cap on non-economic damages in an action, period. The court says it couldn't be clearer, and trying to parse these terms isn't going to get you anywhere. And then what the court does is the court says, interestingly, should any lingering doubt exist on this point, let's just look at the legislative history and see what was intended, meaning that if the statute isn't as clear to everyone as it is to the court, let's look at the history.
Mr. Kennedy, what about if there's consolidated action, so there's two actions consolidated into one case to proceed? Does that impact it at all?
I don't think so. You're looking and just saying, what does the statute mean? And it really shouldn't impact it. What does the legislative history tell us here about this statute? Well, first, and I'll respond to a couple of points that were just made. The Jones versus Heller case order is relied upon by the petitioners. Jones versus Heller is an unreported decision. It's an order, we all know what Supreme Court Rule 123 says. I'm not going to make a big deal out of it, except that to stand here and argue what the case means and what it says is a little difficult because that's an unpublished order. And if you read it, the first thing you notice is it's a plurality of 3, 2, and 1. Even if you can argue it under 123, that order doesn't stand for anything. All you can get from reading it is it says to the Secretary of State, you didn't do a very good job here describing what is in the initiative petition, do it again and try to do a better job. The court didn't decide what was in the initiative, what was not in, what it stood for, or anything else. If you read that order, it just says to the Secretary of State, this is not a good description. There are argumentative things in here. Try to do a better job. And the Secretary of State does a better job. To say, as the petitioners say, that this court has somehow ruled on the petition, what it covers and what it doesn't cover, simply incorrect. Court didn't do that in that order at all. Second, with respect to Upchurch and the what Upchurch decided or didn't decide, Upchurch doesn't come nearly as close or isn't nearly as broad as the petitioners say it is. First off, I think it really doesn't help us on two levels. The first is it deals with a separate statute. And if you look, as I know the court did, at 41035, you see that 41035 contains language that is very similar to the language that was removed from from 41A035 by the initiative petition. That language that was removed from, the language that is in 41035 is to or for the benefit of any claimant, meaning all claimants, no matter how many there are entitled to a certain recovery. That very similar language, which is a very similar language, was removed from 41A031 to each plaintiff from each defendant. To say that Upchurch stands for the proposition that the new language in 035 somehow means the same thing as the language that was removed when 031 was repealed, first off, violates some pretty well-settled law of this court that says where there's an amendment, the purpose is to change the law. And then if you look and see what was taken out, you see that the per person, per plaintiff from each defendant was removed. And there and in 41035, that similar language, which is to or for the benefit of any claimant, is still there. So Upchurch doesn't stand for what the petitioner says it stands for, but and that's on a macro level, but on a micro level, if you read the opinion carefully, it's clear that it doesn't stand for that. Because if you read Upchurch, what this court said was, we're trying to figure out if these claims for the benefit of every plaintiff go to every defendant, or if we're simply talking about an incident. And the first thing that this court said was, we've looked at the legislative history. It's no help. We don't know what the legislature intended. So we'll try to figure out on our own what it means. The court went back, looked at a series of cases that went back some years, and said, we have always said that it meant each claimant, but one event, not multiple defendants. And so for purposes of stare decisis, that's what we're going to hold. It was not a legislative intent decision. Legislative intent was essentially missing. The court simply said, what have we done in the past? We're going to stick to it. And then it said, if anybody wants to change this, they're going to have to go to the legislature. That's not the case here. There is a full and very fertile bunch of legislative history on this initiative, and we've cited it in the brief. And again, the arguments that were made saying, well, we really don't know what was going on in the legislature with respect to this, that argument doesn't hold much water if you actually look at the legislative history. I mean, this court said several times in the last 4 or 5 years, if we want to know what was intended in an initiative, well, let's find out what was going on. What were the voters?
Mr. Kennedy, does any of the legislative history address, rebut, qualify the interpretation that this court attached to the word action in Upchurch?
It does. And it
expressly
says
expressly.
No, not expressly.
I didn't find Upchurch referenced anywhere.
If you look, it says that, and I'm looking at a couple of things. This is the testimony of Bill Bradley. This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary. March 4th, 2003, page 23, Mr. Bradley says, AB1 on the 18th special session, each family member would have an independent claim for non-economic damages. Under IP1, it's $350,000 per event with no exceptions. So if you think about it, is an answer to your question. Each family member would have a claim. Now it's per event, no exceptions.
Mr. Kennedy, what do we do with 41085, sub 2 and sub 4, as to context of wrongful death actions? Where it provides for the heirs of the decedents and the personal representatives of the decedents may each maintain an action for damages against the person who caused the death. And sub 4 further specifies that each heir has a separate claim for damages in actions brought pursuant subsection 2.
Right. And here's how that can be addressed and reconciled with the argument that we're making. You have to go back through a few cases. But you also have to look at paragraph 3 of 41085. It says that these persons have claims. And subparagraph 3 says, if they arise out of the same wrongful act or neglect, they may be joined. They may be joined. So then, if you go back and you look at the Parker case, the Parker case relies on a California Supreme Court case, Cross. And Parker says, it's not a long opinion, but on the second page, it says that the thrust of the statute, this is under the old wrongful death and survivor statute, 12.090, but this court said the thrust is to have all heirs join in one action. Section 3 of 41085 says all the actions may be joined. Rule 13H of the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure say that in any counterclaim, cross-claim, third-party claim, you can join under Rules 19 and 20, just like you can if you're the plaintiff. And very importantly, if you read the Cross case, the California Supreme Court case, I think it's a Supreme Court case, that this court relied on in Parker. Cross says, of course you're going to join all of these claims together. It says a defendant can't be expected to have to defend a series of claims for wrongful death and survivorship and by heirs. The California Supreme Court says these claims are all going to be joined. I mean, that's the understanding. And in that case, it goes back and reconciles a bunch of prior California cases that have used different and varying terms. And the California Supreme Court said in that case, regardless of what the terms are that you use, these claims have to be joined. So, Chief Justice Douglas, to answer your question, that is how these separate claims are dealt with, is they're joined in one action. The statute says it. Rule 13H says it. Parker says that's the thrust of the law, relying on Cross, and Cross from the California Supreme Court says, yeah, that is how these have to be handled because you can't litigate them all separately. Now, can someone come up with a hypothetical that says, well, you know, there may be a case where this can't be done, et cetera, et cetera? Sure. Okay, of course you can, where you have
which raises an interesting question here. Perhaps we shouldn't entertain this writ until the jury has rendered an award in this case, and the district court judge has tried to figure out how in the world to allocate $350,000, assuming the plaintiff prevails, among the plaintiffs, and designate which defendant has to pay it.
You are correct, Your Honor, and that, of course, is an option this court has after the oral argument, is to say we are not going to entertain the writ at this point. That's surely one of the court's options because, I mean, the damages may not even get to that limit. As the court said in Parker, there is an allocation process. Some persons may then be aggrieved and some may not be aggrieved.
Does the statute offer any guidance on allocating?
No, I don't think that it does. I think that the statute and the cases simply say that the court's going to have to apportion this.
Does the absence of allocation raise some question about the enforceability of the statute?
Well, I think what the cases say, it could. Let me just answer it that way. It could, but if you look carefully at the equal protection analysis, you might come to the opposite conclusion. Mm-hmm. Some of the equal protection cases say you have the right to sue, you have the right to make a claim, but there's no guarantee of what recovery you'll make, if any recovery. Sorry, I've used up all of Mr.
Kennedy. Mr. Kennedy, before you walk away, just going back to 41085, because as it relates back to 41A035, we have language problems as usual with our statutes in the state of Nevada, because in the sub 2, it talks about may each maintain an action in sub 2, and then sub 4 talks about claims for damages. And then we get to 035, which talks about an action. So how do we corral these wonderful terms of art so they make sense?
Mr. Chief Justice, I don't know how the statute was written to use those separate terms, but I mean, I was here not too long ago on another statute that made absolutely no sense, and I had to offer the same explanation. I don't know. All I can do is refer the court to the reasoning of the California Court of Appeals in Yates, where the Court of Appeals said, look, here's the statute. We think it's clear. If it's not, look at the legislative intent, which is very plentiful here. And it is clear from that there was to be one limit of $350,000. Whether you call things claims or actions or causes of action, the legislative intent was clear. And if you look back at the Cross case from the California Supreme Court, which this court relied on in Parker, that's one of the things that the California Supreme Court did. It looked at all these cases and said, boy, we have called these things everything over the years, and what we're going to do is try to clear that up by saying there's one action, and all of these must be combined in one action, and regardless of what we may have called them, it is clear that there is to be one action. The bottom line, Your Honor, is I don't have any explanation for the use of those two terms in the statute.
Mr. Postenberg, you have about 2 seconds. We'll give you 3 minutes. And I know my colleagues will hate me later for this.
I think Mr. Kennedy is retribution for my sins past. Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. Dan Postenberg for Dr. Shake. Let me address the meaning of the statute on a textual level and address the Chief Justice's issues about 41.085. Under 41.085, there are two different types of actions, and that is an action that the estate can bring to get special damages and an action brought by all the heirs together to get their own individual grief and sorrow and to get the past pain, suffering, and disfigurement by the decedent, which is a lump sum. And this court said, as Mr. Kennedy pointed out in Parker, relying on Cross, that all the heirs have to be joined together in one action. So as we've argued in Dr. Shake's brief, that the wrongful death statute 41.085 means that there are two actions, one by the estate, which isn't it an issue here because it's economic damages and won by all the heirs together? Justice Hardesty asks, how do we divide that? That's an issue we used to have all the time because before 1979, the wrongful death statute was in Chapter 12, and it was completely a lump sum for the heirs. And the statute provided that the court have to distribute that money in a way that it was equitable and fair. Now, how do you do that? How do you do that when you have a cap on economic non-economic damages? There are a number of ways you can do that. The parties can do it by agreement. The court could look at the individual evidence, and just the way we used to do before 1979 and split it out. Or you could do what happened in the Arsino case, where you ask the jury to decide how much each heir recovers, and then you could split the $350,000 proportionally along that. Let me go to the meaning of 41A.035, and let me do the abbreviated version. Plaintiffs argue that in an action is a term of art in Nevada and has been defined in Upchurch. That's not true. Judge Wagner in Upchurch started out by saying it's ambiguous. We can't determine what it means. And then turned to the legislative history of 41035 and said there is no legislative history. We can't determine what it means. And then went through this court's prior decisions and said, well, look, we always used to divide it up among the plaintiffs. Well, that's wrong, too, because in all those decisions, except Arsino, you were dividing it up among individually injured plaintiffs, a husband and wife together in an accident. They're both injured. State versus Webster, State versus Eaton, a mother and a child, a mother injured, child killed. Each one of those got a cap because they were individually injured. Justice Gibbons, if you consolidated two cases where you had two injured plaintiffs, two injured patients, and that's what in my brief I submitted the injured plaintiff means, is the physically injured patient, not the people who are recovering derivatively. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, for giving me time. I appreciate that.
Counsel, we give you additional 3 minutes because you have 1 second on the clock.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. If I may return, Justice Hardesty, to your question about the presumption that this statute mirrors California statute. And the language that's been identified is in an action and plaintiff being singular. That is the same language that the prior statute contained, in an action. And again there, plaintiff was singular. Yet there's no argument on the other side that that statute was presumed to follow California law. These presumptions that they're invoking are presumptions that are supposed to be aids to the court to discern what the voters intended. But they're not being used that way by the other side, because at the same time that they admit that the voters were never told that the initiative would apply per incident, that this would be the change in the law, they're urging the court to ignore that reality and nonetheless presume that the voters wanted something they were simply not made conscious of, that was not even presented to them, that the arguments advocating passage didn't even explain or didn't even trump as a good reason to vote for the Coden initiative. And this court has repeatedly said that ballot materials are important and need to inform the court, the voters, of any material changes to the law proposed. And that's simply not a change that was proposed to the voters. But there's also a competing presumption here. And that presumption is that when legislation uses words that have accumulated meaning over time, terms of art, that this court has defined, it is presumed that the meaning that this court has given those words is the meaning that is intended to be adopted in subsequent legislation. And so this court, for about 7 years prior to the passage of the initiative and County of Clark versus Upchurch, made very clear that the language in an action and arising out of an act or occurrence established a per plaintiff, per claim cap. It said that in an action refers to a cause of action. It said it again in Parker when it was construing the prior wrongful death law. It said in an action refers to cause of action. It said that although the causes of action must be maintained in a single suit, it also said very clearly that the statute establishing joinder does not create a single cause of action. That is specifically what Parker said. That is also what Cross said. It also said the award of damages in a lump sum does not destroy the separability of the causes of action, because each heir may be awarded separate damages and the lump sum amount may be distributed among the parties equitably based on their own individual losses. Now, there was a reference to the language in Upchurch. Is my time up, Your Honor?
Your time is up, but conclude your thought.
Okay. Your Honor, this case is about a voter initiative. It's not about legislation. It's about what the voters wanted when they voted for the Coden initiative. And what the voters decided to do was to enact a stricter cap, a cap that does not contain two exceptions, which would remove the cap in cases of exceptional circumstances or gross negligence. That is the change that was presented to them. That is the change they voted on. And that is the change supported by this court's precedents in the language. Thank you very much.
I thank counsel this morning, I think, as to their arguments, as to the clarity of our case law and the clarity of the words in the statute. With that, this matter will stand.
All right.